just doing the final checks on my kit bag. This particular journey is with the International Humanitarian Convoy organised by Hyatt. All going well, I'll be hooking up with a journalist friend of mine in Turkey on the southern coast near Syria. And then we hope to be going in and reporting, documenting on the masses of vulnerable civilians all displaced inside and outside Syria. These refugee camps are getting larger and larger every day. So I think I've got everything I need. Just need some sleep, and tomorrow it all begins.
A few hours later, Birmingham to Istanbul to Gaziantep, and I'm just walking the last 100 yards to the hotel. This city is asleep because it's 3 a.m. and here I am. Just need to find out what room I'm in.
Hello. Hey, nice to see you. How are you doing?
How are you, man? Personal escort, well suspicious. He's just turning up at 3 a.m. waking me from my sleep.
I didn't tell him.
I just looked at the map and I didn't realise how far I'd travelled from Istanbul last night. I arrived in the early hours of the morning and I was really excited to get to this small backstreet hotel because I was catching up with a very good friend of mine, Phil Sands, who writes for The National and has spent an awful lot of time in this neck of the woods, Syria, Damascus in particular, Baghdad. We've worked together in Amman, Cairo, Khartoum, in Sudan. Scary moments sometimes.
Yeah, it's true. I've forgotten all of those places, actually.
So how come you're not in Damascus right now?
I'd lived there for years, 3.5, I always say, but it might have been more. And I was registered there as a journalist, but in February, my work credential expired and the government didn't renew it. And so I was obliged to leave the country, basically. Maybe a little bit dramatic to say it, because I wasn't kicked out, but I was kind of asked to leave without being asked to leave, which is a very Syrian thing to do. It's difficult to work there as a journalist, and I'd been to some contentious places and written from some contentious places, and I think that was kind of, maybe that was noted, and you know, it'd been conveyed to me that they weren't happy with that, and yeah, so I didn't get my renewal, and I think I had been the only Western journalist living and working there throughout the, what do we call it, they call it a crisis, throughout the revolution, throughout the war, and so yeah, I was in a privileged position for a couple of years, and now I've lost that privileged position.
You do self-deprecating quite well when you say, oh, you know, I'm not shooting much digital anymore, I'm doing film. And then you explain why, because recently you get taken into a particular office and questioned, and straight away the metadata on your digital images is giving away where you were, what you were looking at, and you were very quietly thankful that you'd shot off a whole load of film of quite sensitive information in a rebel hospital.
Yeah, I'd been down there and been doing these things and got arrested, whatever we say, a checkpoint, detained, dragged off a bus by the army and taken back to a military interrogation installation, quite a notorious one. I'd stopped recording anything audio in Syria for the longest time and taking no notes about names because it's dangerous. You can get people killed if you write names and phone numbers down. So I'd write everything in shorthand notes, which, you know, even I struggle to read sometimes, to be honest, in a notepad. And that's the way I would do business. And, you know, during the interrogation, they pulled the memory card out of my camera. And I'd only taken 2 digital photographs because, you know, I was interested in trying to do film. And they just, in front of me, you know, popped it in the computer and kind of call up this picture on a screen. And in fact, it was a piece of graffiti written on a side of a school that said, "Don't go, Bashar, we're coming for you." You know, and so they could identify the school, which means suddenly they're like, oh, we know where this guy's been. We know what he's doing. And it helps them with the interrogation. But again, happily, I had 5 or 6 rolls of film in my pocket that they were not interested in because it was a film camera, it was medium format film, you need kind of special chemistry to develop it. They couldn't look at it, you know, and had they tried, they would have exposed the frames. And so I suddenly thought, wow, this has protected me and it's protected all the people I know. It's safety right there. You know, when I did get freed, I had to straight away phone the people who had helped me and say, listen, I hope I haven't compromised you and your location because they had this information. I suspect it's happened a lot more than gets reported because journalists don't report about ourselves and our own mistakes. Then I know a few cases where people have really gotten into trouble because of sloppy journalism. You know, people writing things in notebooks, getting detained, and then, like, you know, activists and people who have been helping you will get rolled up by the security forces because they've just walked into a hotel room and found a contact book. Mm. It's a dangerous business. You know, I do think it's really important as a journalist, you know, your own security is a priority, but so should the security of everyone and meeting you. And it's easy to say that, but it's kind of hard to do. And sometimes you can be careless, and sometimes there's the pressure to get a story. And the people who are helping you want you to get the story as well. And they sometimes take shortcuts and risks, and it's complicated and difficult stuff, you know. And it's not pleasant, actually.
I'm on a pretty packed bus leaving Gaziantep, heading southeast towards the Syrian border, surrounded by aid workers, activists, journalists, lawyers with an interest in humanitarian issues and civil liberties of refugees, and been promised access to a field hospital. Been warned that a lot of the things I'm going to see will be life-changing, and there's a lot of stuff I'm really not looking forward to, but a lot of stuff I really feel I have to experience in order to understand more, and in order to hopefully pass on some of that understanding and share some of what's going on in this region of the world. Incidentally, this will probably be some of the last geotagged content that I post live due to the dangers of actually telling anybody where we're going to be at what time. The last time that happened in this particular region, a hospital was destroyed. So obviously I don't want to call in any airstrikes through my thoughtlessness. So I'm going to be very conscious about what I'm sharing and when.
Stood at the Syrian border, there's a small press conference in Arabic at the moment, in front of three columns of trucks carrying relief across the border into Syria. Islamic Relief banners, Hayat Convoy for Syria banners emblazoned on the front of these trucks, whilst photographers and videographers who've travelled down to the border to capture the crossing gather around a spokesperson talking about what's on these trucks, who they're intended for, and what they hope to achieve from this.
My name is Wafa Al-Yaqoubi. I am the spokeswoman of the Hayat convoy, which will last for 4 days. We'll be visiting some camps inside Syria and inside Turkey. It is mainly an independent convoy initiated by people from different countries all over the world, almost 20 trucks. The aids are mainly 10,000 food packages. We have 11 ambulance cars. We have 10 tons of medicine, 2,000 mattresses. We have 2,000 hygiene packages, also 2,000 baby kits. And parallelly with our material, let's say, aids, we have also psychological support. A team was gathered, and they have already entered yesterday in the camps, and they will also be visiting some other villages inside Syria to give psychological support.
My name is Yusuf Karaja.
Can you tell me a little bit about the space that we're standing in right now?
5 months. Until now, we live here. So, and I have my brother. We have one room here, the one kitchen, and one bathroom also. And we are 12 who live here.
So, do all 12 sleep in this room? Or no. Spread between the
me
two?
And my wife, we sleep in another, in Najikan, and another, they're sleeping here.
It's hot.
Really, it's hot. It's hot. And we can't bring AC here. That's the problem here in the summertime.
So you've got a heater, but that doesn't help you in the day.
Yeah.
And how does your family do for food?
We have the visa card. It's from Red Moon, the Turkish Red Moon.
Yeah.
For every person here in the camp, they give every 15 days, 15 Turkish lira.
So why are you on this side of the border and not on the other side of the border?
Maybe because my city is here near this border. We have like 4 kilometers.
Do you feel luckier because you're on the Turkish side?
Yeah, better come from here. Everything here, it's good. Syrian people there in the border, you saw so many people there in the tent. It's so much bad. It's we are here, we say, Alhamdulillah, it's nice for us. We have so many camps in Syria, just tents. It's not like this container. Go to Atma camp. They have 27,000 persons there. It's wow. Very bad. We are here, we are Alhamdulillah, we are good. Before 1 year and a half, I came to Syria to help the people here. I told you I'm a pharmacy.
Yeah.
So that's why I bring my family to here. It's safe here. Before she lived with me in Azaz, when the flyings come to Azaz and they give us bomb, it's dangerous for us.
Yeah. We left because of the bombing.
That's why.
How long will you be here for? Do you know?
When the problem in Syria is finished, we have to go back. My life is okay here because I told you it's safe more than from Syria. There is dangers.
Just broke through the others and found a small coffee shop. Effectively, just a plastic tarpaulin tent
and heated water in some flasks. Yeah, it's by far the best coffee I've had since travelling to Turkey. And it's in a refugee camp. How strange is that? And the man was so courteous and full of stories and fascinating information. He only spoke Arabic, so Phil was mainly talking with him. And when I said, what's the coffee shop called? He said, it's the free coffee shop, because coffee is free. And he refused, absolutely refused, to take any money from us. He even let me take his photo, which I felt like a thief when I did it. Just incredible people here, really. To think what they've gone through, what they've escaped, what they've fled from. And here they are, the little businesses set up inside a sprawling refugee camp. And you can tell so many feel very lucky to be alive. Trucks and forklifts and people obviously waiting for some kind of clearance, paperwork or passport. This is the no man's land between Turkey and Syria, and I'm currently walking towards Syria in the hope my passport can be stamped by the Free Syrian Army and they'll let me in, and I can see the refugee camps for myself. It's busy, really busy. Sat on a bus somewhere inside Free Syria. The crossing was long and tedious, as you'd imagine, but there was a lot of pleasant people around, a lot of happy people, a lot of people giving the victory sign as they crossed, and people wanting to have their photographs taken under the Free Syria posters which adorn the walls of passport control, and AK-47s in the hands of soldiers more than willing for you to take their portrait. Apart from the occasional bombed out building and group of refugees maybe moving between tents, you wouldn't think that this was a country still at war 2 years in.
We are here in Rai Hospital, which is funded and operated mainly by the Arab Medical Union. We have a clinic, we have operative room, we have inpatient for men and inpatient for women. We have also intensive care. We have pharmacy, a room for X-ray, a lab, small lab also. We operate for about 180 or 200 operations each month. Some of these cases are from the emergency, from the war, and also we give a service for cold cases. We have a clinic for pediatric, for neurosurgery, for general surgery, for vascular surgery. Also we have for internal medicine. We also receive like an emergency, I think around 50 patients per day. But some days are like very calm, like today, but other days are very hot, depending on the like degree of fighting. I am a neurosurgeon. I operated for 30 patients only in this month. 50% of these patients having blast injury in the head. Many patients have also bullets or blasts in the spine. Some of them are paraplegic or quadriplegic. Whenever we had to do like urgent surgery for these patients, we usually admit him urgently and do the surgery and then keep him in the intensive care unit for a few days. Some patients, mainly from civilians, who need only intensive care unit, sometimes the relatives ask for referral to other hospitals in Turkey. We also help them to like bringing ambulance for them to go across the border. I myself and my colleagues also here expect that this war will not end so soon. We're expecting that it may take like a few months or maybe years. So the people here are really very poor. Like there's no health care system. So I'm looking for the future. I expect that we need really maintenance in terms of infrastructure, equipment, and also the supply. Sultan, he's a boy around 5 years old. He has amputation. He lost his leg. He lost his genitalia also during last injury. The general surgeon here kept cleaning the wound, and I think he is really in need for rehabilitation, maybe artificial limb or something. Khadija is a female around 16 years old. She has last injury in the spine, and because of that she became paraplegic. She also has exploration in the abdomen. And now she is stable, but she cannot move, and she also needs rehabilitation.
I thought it was thunder you said, "Did you not hear that mortar fire?" as we walk briskly towards the border, and how lucky we are to actually have passports and be able to cross. We saw an ambulance toing and froing regularly, or a number of ambulances. I guess it can't be the same one unless people are bringing bodies up to the border.
Yeah, I think they ferry up the wounded. The really badly wounded sometimes get brought into Turkey for better medical treatment than they can get inside Syria.
Well, it's very sporadic, like, I guess, pot shots would be.
And that seems to be the way they do it. You know, they fire a few shots or whatever up a bit north in areas where, you know, the regime cannot be. But I don't know, it almost seems like kind of harassing fire. You know, I don't know if they're aiming at anything in particular or just trying to keep people frightened and on their toes and stuff, which of course works.
When we were packing this morning and you said, "Here, I'll take one of those." What was it, that Medi pack?
It's just a first aid kit, basically, but it's got something in it that, you know, if you get some kind of bad bleeding wound, you put this pad on it and it basically seals up the wound. Because, again, I think in Syria, you know, a lot of people bleed to death from perfectly preventable things. You know, they'll get shot, and if there was a good medic there with the right equipment, they'd save their life. But the facilities are very rudimentary, so that doesn't happen. But, yeah, it's one of those things. It seems kind of melodramatic when you got it, but it's almost like if you're superstition as well. Like, if you've got it, nothing's going to happen. The day you don't pack it is the day you wish you'd brought it along. And so it's sort of to guard against the juju spirits or whatever.
Well, I never remember you being this paranoid, and I kind of like it. This is a healthy level of preparedness. And I did give you a funny look when you handed it to me, but I dropped it in the bag because you never do know. And with mortar fire behind you, as you're approaching a border which is going to close. So if we couldn't have got to that border, we would have been finding somewhere within a couple of miles of a mortar attack to spend the night.
And almost more worrying than that, you know, again, the borders are not stable, and the armed groups, they have fairly significant problems between them, you know, in terms of fighting between the opposition groups over who gets control of what border, because a border is really lucrative. And so firefights sometimes break out, borders sometimes get closed because of firefights, like randomly. And also there are kidnappings inside Syria. You know, I think it happens a lot more than you would see in the news, because a lot of them do not get reported, because they get fixed up in a way that journalists, certainly, and aid workers and things like that can go back in, and they don't burn any bridges with people. But it happens a lot. And so it's just one of those things. I do think, you know, my old age, that there's no point in taking unnecessary risks, basically. You know, you can get the stories without doing anything too sort of stupid. I don't know. Maybe that's not fair.
It's all well and good putting yourself in this situation, but if you end up as another statistic, you're not ultimately really helping any amplification of a story, whether or not that ultimately has any effect on people's perceptions. That was another mortar going off then. You know, you just got to hope that you're doing the right thing in capturing and sharing the stories, and that it may have some effect. It's very easy to be disillusioned when you see the kind of things that you see. We're approaching the final passport check, and we are standing on Turkish soil. Okay, so we drove 3 hours to get to a border near a camp in Syria that we'd like to see, and when we got there we were told the border was actually closed, yet due to some of the contacts within the group, we're able to arrange for a small group of five, myself included, to cross over into Syria illegally, i.e. no passport stamp out and in, which in one way puts me at the mercy of the Syrian Free Army, but I kind of trust the people that I'm with. After all, anything that I can share of what's happening on the other side here is kind of a good thing for them. So it's in their interest to keep me safe. And at the moment, I'm wearing a staff badge of a humanitarian organisation, and I haven't had to show any paperwork to get through. Once you get to the other side here, it's a completely different story to the other border crossing. There's a kind of a forced march for people who want to cross over because no vehicles allowed because of a car bomb last week. And there's a lot of weaponry, a lot of sidearms, and a lot of fighters, and I don't know if they're just kind of resting here in no man's land, or actually protecting the border. A lot of trucks, I believe, seemingly getting to the border and then having to offload. I'm about 200 yards from a sign saying "Welcome to Syria," and this will be my second entrance, and on this occasion a very different one with a very different feeling indeed.
I am Safiya Amri from Morocco.
What are you doing here in this school underneath a refugee camp in northern Syria?
Actually, I'm trying to help as much as I can. I am a filmmaker and I am trying to make a documentary film.
So why this particular school?
I've been to many places, and this school actually is something interesting because education stopped, like, it's been 2 years now, and this was a formal school, normal one, and it was not working, but Watan organization tried to restore it, and they're trying to give some activities, some kind of education to the children in the camp and in the town itself.
So how many students and how many teachers on service staff?
Students are 1,100 child, and the teachers, it's like 30 between teachers and administration.
Who pays the teachers? Who pays the staff?
Most of them are volunteers. Sometimes there are some indemnities, but most of them are volunteers.
So all the children here, 1,100, they all can learn for free?
Yes, they pay nothing.
Do they have many materials, pencils, pens?
They're not enough, of course. There's like a continual need for materials.
And what is the name of this school?
The name of this school is the Generation of Freedom.
A very hopeful name.
Yes, of course, they need hope. They really need hope. And they like the word freedom. It was really important.
So the ages of the children here?
Are from 6 to 15 years old.
The songs they're singing, they are protest songs.
Yes, they are singing mostly protest song, and this is the kind of song they're insisting actually on singing. Even though we ask them sometimes, like, sing anything else that you know, like songs that we all know from the Arab world, and they're like, no.
So where do they learn these songs?
They learned it during the protests, because the protests continued for a long time in their towns. So this is like the thing that they're hearing every day from their parents' mobile phones, their brothers' mobile phones. So, like, it's all over the place.
So these were children born into protest?
Yes, you can say that in Syria there is such a thing, a child born into protests.
How do you feel about their state of mind? How do you feel about their mental health with all the suffering, with all the war, with all the tragedy that's around them right now?
Actually, they will never forget it, that's for sure, but I think they're going to be able to carry on living. Because most of them, if you ask them, they think they are stronger than the regime. They think they are stronger than Bashar al-Assad. They think they're going to defeat him. So this is a good thing that many other children living under revolution didn't have.
Do you think that if this continues, many of these children will become fighters?
I think if this continues, every child that will reach maybe the age of 14 will have a gun in his hand, and maybe already do.
There is an incredible feeling of and strength of spirit everywhere in northern Syria at the moment. Do you think with the children, this strength of spirit is what's going to carry them through when they are playing goodies and baddies, they are playing the regime and the free selves? Do you think this is enough to carry them through?
It's surely not enough, but it's something that's going to help them for sure.
Well done. There's some beautiful, incredible children here.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Thank you.
Civilized people living in a very uncivilized way through no choice of their own. This is the largest refugee camp in Syria, and to say it's squalid is an understatement. People living here kind of desperate situation. Like a small city, 30,000 people, I think I was told.
Hello.
God, I can't believe they still manage high spirits.
What a crazy day, a long day, kind of zigzagging across the Turkish-Syrian border. I'm now back in Turkey, Today, we kind of teamed up with an organisation outside of the Hayat Convoy group. I realised we're actually illegally crossing into Syria. And illegally crossing into Syria was not necessarily something I planned on doing at the beginning of the trip, but that's what was happening. The Atma camp. And that just completely blew my mind. My experience of refugees before are quite a desperate people, normally strewn around a city, given pretty squalid living conditions and refused papers to move freely, but they have a roof over their head quite a lot of the time, and sometimes they might even have a heater and enough of the basic essentials. Nothing like this, though. You drive up a long, winding, and some may say kind of beautiful, almost Grecian mountain pass into kind of a sparsely wooded, dusty area, and you kind of see the litter and the rubbish strewn initially, and a lot of it's kind of plastic, which is blown from loose lean-tos and tarps and shelters built from anything. And there might be a naked child just kind of standing there, staring at you. You're in a minibus pulling in, feeling a little bit like a perverted tourist wanting to see, you know, the most depressing places in the area, and then hitting the jackpot because it's known to be the worst refugee camp in all of Syria. 23,000 people, and this city is born, and it's kind of crazy because they don't have the infrastructure for this. There's a kind of a weird dirt track high street going up the hill where the tents aren't necessarily for just living in. There might be a small bench made of bricks and scrap wood with something on to sell, so it's effectively a high street of shops, but shops used in the loosest of terms. People just desperately trying to trade or sell something so that they can feed their family. People rush up to you and they're desperate for help and assistance. I've not experienced that since some of the most poverty-stricken areas of India or Africa. And a kid had his hand in my bag trying to grab something, and what could I say? You know, you have nothing. I'm walking in like a Christmas tree, dangling goodies, and you'd be a fool not to try and take something from me. You're hungry, really hungry. And I had this kind of power bar on me that I handed over to a kid at one point, and there's almost a fight over it, and I've seen that when I was travelling India, but for some reason it hit me harder this time. This is very real, because these people have escaped the horrors of war only to find themselves in a situation where they may still die from disease, from famine, or from one case that I heard where a candle was knocked over in a tent. The tent just went up in 6 seconds and they had no chance at all. And 7 children died from one family. I feel very lucky to be where I am right now. I don't know if I feel lucky to have been able to witness the things that have been going on in Syria. I know I've not even scraped the surface. Sharing these stories is a very small thing if it doesn't make people do something, act in some way, and yet I guess money does make a difference, because I witnessed a convoy of vehicles go in with medical supplies, with beds, with food. So stuff is definitely being done. It's just how to build on that. It's quite intense. There's so many things I couldn't share in real time due to huge security issues. Just tweeting roughly a location or sharing a photograph that might be recognised could call an airstrike in, so apologise for rambling. It's the early hours of the morning. The windows open in the hotel room as I try to stay cool. And I'm thinking about those people who are probably cold, sleeping on the dirt, not far away from here.